session number 9173, reel 2.
John Medway, tape 2. Could I ask you now about the Greek and Turkish population in Cyprus? I understand that there were more Greek Cypriots than Turkish Cypriots. Is that right?
Yes, the proportions had varied through the ages, but since the Turkish occupation in 1571, but during the British time, it was about 4/5 Greek and 1/5 Turkish. The precise proportions, I think, in 1958 were more like 78-79% Greek and about 18% Turkish, something like that. It is true that in the past the Turks had at times been a rather larger proportion than they were then, but during the British period, the ratio was about 4 to 1.
Mm-hmm. And would that ratio have been reflected in the civil service?
Yes. Certainly, it was British policy, naturally, to try and deal fairly with both communities, but we hadn't, in those days, heard of doctrines such as inverse discrimination. And so although the British certainly tried to hold a balance between the two, the test was always ability and qualifications. And that did indirectly, perhaps, result in a disproportionate number of Greeks in most of the government departments, because their education, they were better tended to be better qualified than the Turkish Cypriots. But in some departments, the police and the judiciary, the Turks were, and the land registry, I believe, the Turks were well represented.
How about the police force?
Well, the police, when the British came, there was a local gendarmerie which had existed under the under Ottoman rule, and they were entirely Turkish, the zaptiyes, as they called them. And to begin with, the British accepted that, and the Cyprus military police, I think, continued for some years to be Turkish, or predominantly Turkish. But then the British saw that it was necessary to recruit Greeks into it, and it became a mixed service. But always the Turks, partly for historical reasons, the Turks always remained disproportionately large element in the police. Apart from historical reasons, of course, I think it would be true to say that the Turks took to this disciplined service in the police perhaps rather more readily than their Greek compatriots. And also, it may have been deliberate policy on Britain's part to recruit a relatively large number of Turks into the police in order to ensure that the force was not vulnerable to any sedition. In 1958, at the end of the emergency, there were nearly as many Turks as Greeks in the ordinary regular police force, and then there were the auxiliary forces which were recruited during the emergency and which were a considerable bone of contention between the Greek Cypriots and the British administration. And they were virtually all Turks. I think in the auxiliaries there were only about 70 Greeks as against 1,700 Turks. And in the mobile force, they were all Turks, about 540, something like that.
Yes, I must ask you about that later, you know, when we look at that period. Could you tell me something more about the characteristics, the different characteristics of the Greeks and Turks, you know, which you have mentioned?
Yes, certainly. Well, physically, it wasn't always very easy to distinguish them, and it may be indeed that there isn't ethnically all that much difference between them. I remember in the middle of the grimmest days of the Eoka conflict, a young Irish doctor who was working in Cyprus came up with the results of a study of blood groupings, I think it was, that he'd carried out between Greeks and Turks, and he'd come to the conclusion that they were quite markedly different, the Greeks from the Greeks of the mainland and the Turks from the Turks of the mainland, but the Greek and Turkish Cypriots were almost indistinguishable. that may or may not be true. You couldn't easily distinguish that there were differences in dress in the rural people and so on, but for the most part it wasn't easy to distinguish them physically. The Greeks, again, as a result of the much better educational facilities that they had available, partly anyway for that reason, appeared to be quicker in the uptake, more energetic, and in some ways more capable. They really are an extremely talented people, and you don't have to be living among them for very long without realizing that. On the Turkish side, also very better educated people in the towns were certainly the equal of the Greeks, and you got a sort of impression with them of solidity, which you didn't always get with the Greeks. And of course, the Turks had been an imperial power in their time, and I think. To some extent, I don't think it's fanciful to feel that was still reflected in the, at any rate, the Turkish Cypriot aristocracy. In the villages, again, there wasn't all that much difference, but I think one's impression was that the Turkish Cypriots were a bit slower in the uptake, more stubborn when they got something into their heads, and more conservative than the Greek Cypriots. But I don't think one should overemphasize the difference between the two. And now, I won't speak about now.
The issue of education seems quite an important one. Were they educated completely separately?
Yes. It's almost true to say that. Early on, the British took the decision, and it was obviously a reasonable decision, and I think most people would say a right decision, to continue the existing state of affairs, where the Greek children were given a Greek education and the Turkish children a Turkish education. In the early days, there were some of our Victorian proconsuls who thought that what we ought to have done was to have made English the lingua franca of the whole island, and given the children an English-speaking education, and that this would have been a unifying influence, and in the end brought about a new concept of nationhood, Cyprus for the Cypriots rather than a Greek and Turkish elements. However, I think the decision taken was that, as I say, that the education should remain Greek and Turkish, and the curricula and a lot of the teaching staff were actually recruited from the mainland. That again was reasonable enough because in order to pass their sort of baccalaureate examinations, it was right that they should work to the same curricula and requirements as in the in Greece and Turkey. There was some little a small degree of education of an English type. There was a very good boarding school, the English school established in the 1930s, I think, in Nicosia, and then American Academy in Larnaca and Nicosia, and they gave the children from about the age of 12, something like that, an English-speaking education, and they were very, very successful, those schools. To begin with, elementary education had been left in the hands of the local communities with the financial support from the government. And that, of course, meant that the church was very strong indeed in its influence over education at the elementary level. But after the 1930 riots, the government took charge of education at the elementary stage, but it left secondary education still in the hands of the local communities. So the Greek gymnasium and the Turkish lycée were run by boards of Greek and Turkish Cypriots and continued to rely a good deal on support in the way of teachers, textbooks and so on from Greece and Turkey. Naturally enough, in those in the circumstances in Cyprus, that meant that at the secondary level there was a great deal of political indoctrination. Whether the British were wise or not to leave that system unchanged, who can say? Certainly there would have been a very, very strong reaction from the two communities in Cyprus and from Greece and Turkey and from opinion outside, including Britain, if the government had at any time tried to take control of secondary education. So although the decision to leave it there can be criticised on grounds of political expediency, and obviously one of the major reasons for the final turmoil in Cyprus was the nature of the education that the young people had been given. But on the other hand, I think one can also applaud the liberalism of the British imperialists in leaving this very, very important section of public activity in Greek and Turkish hands.
So this would have been a very important factor for the separate nationality of those two groups.
Well, there's no doubt that the secondary schools became a sort of hotbed of nationalism, and when the emergency happened, the school pupils in the secondary, in the Greek secondary schools, were a real thorn in the flesh of the British administration. It may be, it has been suggested, that the security forces spent too much of their time trying to control agitation among the secondary school pupils and the waving of flags and demonstration and throwing stones. But of course we have other examples close to us now of where rioting children and teenagers are a real problem for the security forces. There wasn't ever a university in Cyprus, and again, looking back on it, people have sometimes said that if only there had been a university open to both Greek and Turk, that might have been a unifying or at least a sobering element. However, it really wasn't feasible at that time, though there were other institutions. There was a teachers' training college which recruited both Greeks and Turks and taught them mainly in English. And I think you could say that that had some good effect on relations between the communities, things of that kind. But then the young people, when they left school and wanted to go to university, they had the choice of Greece, Turkey, and England. That was virtually the choice. A good many went to Greece and Turkey, particularly to study law and medicine, but a great number also came to Britain. There were obvious reasons for that, I suppose, that by getting qualifications at universities here, they increased their chances of recruitment into the government service, which then was the aim of very many young Cypriots. Nowadays, of course, they tend to go into commerce and industry much more, or to choose the professions of that kind. There were advantages, obviously, in getting qualifications in England and in Britain. And one of the, perhaps the greatest legacy which the British left to Cyprus was the excellence of its civil service, which was to a considerable extent due to the recruitment of young men and women who had received a university education in this country and had made a very good use of it.
What other legacies do you think there were for Cyprus from British rule? Was it a good administration?
Well, yes, I think attention now as we look back tends to be concentrated, very understandably, but perhaps excessively, on the political difficulties which the British had to grapple with. And so people tend to lose sight of the fact that in many ways Cyprus was an extremely well-administered country. The judiciary was just, and impartial, competent. The police force, and up to the time when it was penetrated and to some extent disrupted by EOCA, was very capable and really had had things under their control with great, and had showed great efficiency. There was a very just system of taxation, and including income tax, which, of course, is the sinews of any economic development, to get your taxation system straight. The a complete registration of all property holdings, which was, it sounds like an obvious thing to us here, perhaps, but in that part of the world, a complete detailed and accurate record of property holdings was quite important. The medical services were good, not lavish, but there were decent hospitals in all the main towns and in some of the largest larger villages, a good district medical service, and access for people to medical care. We've spoken about education, and although that was a thorn in the flesh of the British administration, the quality of the service was pretty good. There was no compulsory education, but towards the end of the British period, nearly all children really were getting an education, and illiteracy had almost disappeared. Then there were some really very remarkable achievements. The Forest Administration, for example, was extremely competent and a model, became a model for other developing countries, so that when a forest college was established in Cyprus, we used to get people coming from far afield, from other countries, to study forestry there. The cooperative movement was very powerful, well organized, and one of the, I would guess, one of the most efficient cooperative movements in the whole of the British colonial empire. By a wise law enacted shortly before the Second War, tribunals had been established to hear appeals from farmers in debt to moneylenders. That had been a great curse in the past. And these tribunals had the power to restate the loans and to transfer them from private individuals to banks and so on. And that, together with the increased prosperity for the agricultural community, which occurred during the war, virtually had the effect of wiping out indebtedness among the rural community. That was a great achievement. Then the British also initiated trade unionism and and built up a very strong, powerful trade union movement there. Of course, the ground was very fertile, because the Greeks and the Turks were, it was just the sort of thing that they could manage extremely capably. And some of the negotiators that I came up against from time to time in industrial disputes were extremely competent men. Then tourism, a good deal was done there. Certainly, high standards of management were enforced. A number of good hotels were established, and airport, a tourist advisory bureau, and so on. And the foundations were laid during that period. Though, of course, it's all very small beer by comparison with the remarkable development of tourism that has occurred in recent years. a very good local radio service. The first, Cyprus was the first country, I think, in the Eastern Mediterranean to introduce television. It didn't go awfully well at the beginning because it happened during the Eoka period, and so you got young thugs going around and breaking people's television sets in order to prevent them watching British propaganda. But it was a great step. And then, of course, Cyprus was the very first country, I believe, to eradicate malaria, which had been a great curse in the past. So, all things considered, I would say that Cyprus was pretty well administered, and that although no one would decry in any way the remarkable developments that have occurred since independence, at the same time, credit ought to be given to the fact that the infrastructure for this remarkable development was pretty well all laid during the British period, and particularly during the latter years, even in the unfavourable circumstances of fighting a guerrilla war. There was more money and more effort put into a development in those years than ever before. And here I do believe that full credit ought to be given to the work of the Cypriot civil servants, who really bore the brunt of the development work and did serve their people very, very well indeed. Their achievements, I would say their patriotism, ought to be recognised more than it has been.